Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today's guest is Miguel Arámbula, someone who's become one of the most interesting voices thinking about housing, develop, and the future of downtown Fresno. Miguel is the executive director of the San Joaquin Valley Housing Collaborative, an organization bringing together developers, nonprofits, planners, and policymakers to think regionally about the housing challenges facing the Central Valley. But Miguel is not just interested in talking about policy, he's also building things. In this conversation, we talk about his new downtown bar, Moses McQueen's, which is opening near the stadium and brewery district, and the long road it took to renovate an old building and bring a project to life. We also talk about his efforts to launch a neighborhood farmers market in the Tower District, why housing affordability is ultimately a supply problem, and how regional collaboration can help the Valley compete for housing resources at the state level. Let's go meet Miguel Arámbula. Elevate guests, politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best! Miguel, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Jordan, I like to eat in my backyard and my front yard. I got some cool blood orange tree. I got some fig that's growing, some nice sour cherries. Nibble on if you're desperate.
Where do you like to eat out in Fresno, maybe?
Yeah, I like to walk whatever's close. I'm not that picky. I thought of this line because I listen. I'm a fan, Jordan, so I'm always listening. And I think you strike me as a foodie. And I feel like I'm a hungy, which is I just wait till I get hungry and then everything tastes good.
Are you a grazer or do you like a big meal and then just go about your day?
I will just eat food whenever it's there. And so I will eat. We don't have too many snacks because I got like a young kid. And so she wants to eat everything I do. So she's like a great diet maker. But yeah, I just walk to stuff here by Fresno High, Quesadilla Gorilla, Motos. I like the ice cream shop there. It feels David Lynch. Everybody's so happy. It's like ethereal. You're like, did I just go enter heaven or like some alternate dimension of a creative genius where all is well?
Yeah.
It's really nice.
I do the same thing. I walk down there quite a bit. What, let's say one of those buildings came up for lease right there, one of those spaces. What food could be added to that block that you think people would like and would make sense there? Because we got sandwiches, we got quesadillas, we got ice cream, we got a coffee shop. What do you think it's like?
I got two, Jordan.
Or what is it?
Oh, yeah. The thing that's missing for me generally is a fresh baked bread sandwich place. And so there used to be one like that in Tower, and then they went out of business. And it's like, I mourned them a little bit because I forgot businesses can also stop. And so it's like, it was a beautiful family. They named it after their grandma, and they were just like baking bread for the people. And it was like tasty stuff, different stuff. Just the bread was good, but then you had a sandwich inside. And so it was all around good. And I used to live in Albuquerque and they had one. Some people started and just like a good old bakery that does sandwiches. I think that would be like a hit in that spot. But I guess I don't want to tread on Moto. So I'll also go maybe like a soup place.
Ooh, I was thinking like a burger place, like some place, some kind of like local kind of craft burgers and fries, or a salad place. We don't have enough places where you can just go get a salad or something like that.
Moto's got good ones.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we're just creeping on Carlos.
Moto's got everything. Yeah, let's just go to Moto's and call it a day.
All right, let's jump into housing. How did you first get involved in housing and development in the Central Valley?
I started doing handyman work around my parents' house, and I feel like that was step one, really hands-on. I started working after college at 1x1 Leadership, which was like a faith-based community development corporation. I worked with Craig Sharton in the economic development department. And I helped do, we got a, I think it was from HUD grant to do rehab loans in the Lowell. So I was doing that. And then I started rehabbing the Shigerian house where we had some nonprofits. And the idea at that time on L Street was to have a whole synergistic one block nonprofit campus where It would focus on the revitalization of our urban core and a little bit almost Bitwise or something like that, where there's this, when things are in proximity, you get all kinds of good ideas and crossover. But it was like that for kind of these historic buildings on L Street. So did that over there and learned a lot about construction. Kind of the way that I learned was you would bring a contractor in to give you a bid and you would learn from them. And the second contractor, you would repeat what the first one told you. So it sounded like you knew what you were doing. And by the time the third contractor came, you were at an even par with them. And so just triangulating that way. And yeah, I did a lot of different stuff before housing as well, like teaching. So it's been like a back and forth thing.
Before we jump into the collaborative, I'm curious because you're describing a number of kind of like different vantage points to look at housing. Do you think the problem was clear? It like when you're looking at a problem from different vantage points, you can focus on different things. How did the kind of like myriad experiences you have lead you to diagnosing what's going on with housing in the Central Valley? Did the problem evolve as you learned more facets of the industry?
Yeah, I think the rehab is relevant because ultimately, like, we live in homes and we interact with them and we can improve them outside of a regulatory framework by and large. And so it's a hands-on kind of sweat equity model. You mow your lawn and you change your lights or do whatever. And so and it's a little bit why people sometimes like owning a home, because you end up having to do a lot of the work yourself. And so you're investing eventually, but your time, your labor, the knowledge of it. Doing that community work, it certainly became clear that parts of the community developed in different ways over time, and some were struggling and some were doing better, and gets you to start to ask questions and you don't really know the answers. And I remember when I learned about kind of suburban sprawl and redlining, that it was just like a revelation. And I was like probably in my 30s, and it just connected all of these pieces. It was like a scientist before you knew the germ theory. You just know, like, how come every time I eat old fish, I'm hurling chunks? And then also, if I do something, just lines it all up. And you're like, oh, we've done like a policy over time.
Let me ask you another question. In moving to Fresno and working with housing in different ways in a commentary place in the podcast I did for Fresnoland, I learned a lot of different things about how people perceive advice. We're always getting a lot of advice from Sacramento, from Southern California, and the Bay Area. There's a lot of experts who come in and want to help us understand what our problems are, as well as what solutions there are to our problems. How do you conceptualize and think about people coming from the outside giving advice to housing problems in the Central Valley?
I think it's great. I think there are a lot of good outside experts. I try to stay abreast of a lot of it. I think Lazar Consulting is really good. I like the work that Turner Center does out of UC Berkeley.
Do you
And a
think they
lot of it
understand
is.
our unique issues if they're not from here and they're teleporting in?
Yeah, I think California shares a lot in common, and the struggles of affordability are not unique to the Valley, and almost in a weird way, they're less here than they are in other places. And a challenging kind of regulatory and zoning frame, the complication of different funding streams that come from the feds or the state is shared. So a lot of this type of analysis is very useful and helpful, and it's very welcome. But I also am somebody that thinks that we should be coming up with our own ideas. And I think we almost have a comparative advantage in that we talk to each other more. We're a bit like a small town. It's like we're smaller, and so we can coordinate and communicate better and hopefully solve these things more at a human level than bigger cities and challenges and more complexity.
Let's talk about the collaborative, and I'm referring to the San Joaquin Valley Housing Collaborative. So what I've determined is the kind of strength of the organization is input from a lot of different stakeholders, plus thinking regionally about housing issues. Why are those two things important? Why is it important to increase the number of people at the table and then also think beyond Fresno?
Yeah, people, as Jordan, people have all the information and knowledge, right? And so you're talking to each one, and it's amazing how each person has a missing puzzle piece. And so inviting those conversations, helping people have peer-to-peer conversations, nothing but good things can come from people collaborating and understanding each other more. And housing is complicated because it touches all these sectors: health, education, city planning. And so people can be overwhelmed by that. And
Ever
we're
get too
trying
much
to.
information, and then that kind of creates the challenge of like movement.
Yeah, you could spin your wheels, I'm sure. But yeah, for me, what I'm trying to do at the collaborative is, like, when somebody joins as a member, just to be like specific, just have a little 30-minute conversation with them, and it's amazing what can happen. And then the next time I have a conversation, I can connect some people. So I just learned that housing choice vouchers can be used for home ownership, and so sent those to some CDCs that have affordable homes, which is one of the challenges of people with vouchers looking for homes, is that they're priced out. So just little stuff like that, but then you can imagine as that scales, the solutions hopefully scale as well.
And
And yeah, the idea of,
why do we need a regional approach? Like, why do we care what they're doing in Merced?
yeah, I think the big one is, at a state level, resources are divided by regions in some senses. So the tax credits have set-asides for the Bay Area, for Los Angeles. In one of those, I believe the 4% were grouped with the Inland Empire and Riverside and those kind of places. And we're at a competitive disadvantage. And so what we found is these other regions have regional organizations. Down south, they have SCAMF. In the Bay Area, they have NPH, San Diego, the San Diego Federation for Housing. So there's already people jockeying at the state level to determine the rules. And the devil often is in the details for a lot of this stuff. And so a lot of the people on the board of the collaborative kind of run these affordable housing organizations or in adjacent industries. And they just realize there's a need for the valley to have a voice. Funds typically come from the state level, and so the valley needs a voice at the state.
So we've had a lot of ongoing discussions about one of the favorite subjects that we discussed with Fresno Land, which was SEDA, which is a major development area on the fringe of the city. And I guess what my question is, we hear from developers a lot that very self-interestedly that people just want single family homes and that they want a yard and they want all that kind of, those kind of basic amenities. What's wrong with that story?
I think the data probably doesn't back it up. I liked that book, Missing Middle Housing, and in there they have, I think it's national data, but they also break it up by state. And so they do actually, maybe through the Realtors Association, but they survey people in the community to see what they want. And it was surprising. The numbers might be off, but my recollection is maybe about 60 to 70% wanted single family homes, but we were developing closer to 90%. And there was just a demographic shift happening that wasn't represented in our development, which is young people putting off kids and families for longer, wanting to live in walkable, kind of like places where they can socialize and have fun. We might be able to relate with that, Jordan, I'm not sure. And
Certainly.
then older people who are trying to downsize, and that really matched what my parents were doing. They were in a two-story home. They weren't that interested. They're more interested in, like, making sure they still have regular social connections and walkable neighborhoods. And so I think where I land, and not speaking on behalf of the collaborative, but just having those options for people and just making sure the market reflects. And so I think the what's wrong with that narrative is just it doesn't match maybe where the community has changed over time.
Okay. One of the discussions we often have in public education, which is where I work, is the elephant in the room is always poverty. A lot of you can track kids socioeconomically, and there are some outliers, but oftentimes it's predictive. And so discussions we have is solving poverty the kind of the upstream solution to all these downstream things like inequities and educational performance, housing issues. So do you think really poverty is just a downstream effect, or housing is just a downstream effect of poverty, and the real approach is to work on the first order question, and then there will be second order effects for other areas like education or housing? What do you think about people that make that argument?
First off, I really like it. I like that book, Upstream. Not sure if you read it.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Informative. And while you were saying that, I was actually thinking of like Wild Water Adventures, the Circle Stream.
Because
like poverty could be a result of poor education, and poor education results can be a result of poverty. But just as you were saying that, I was thinking it's not really like you described, because oftentimes we're seeing the greatest housing affordability problems in the places with the highest incomes and the most economic growth. And so if supply can't really expand to meet the demand and the growth in wages, then people bid up the price for the housing that exists. And so sometimes policies that just pour more money into a housing ecosystem that does not provide more housing, it doesn't really solve the housing problem. And so I'm somebody personally who believes that housing does respond to supply and demand to an extent, to a large extent. And you know, what helps keep the price down is a lot of supply of housing. And I'm basing that off of homelessness as a housing problem. And they did the kind of econometric data to check that. And the two big variables that reflect the amount of homelessness are the vacancy rate and I think the median rent or something like that. So just essentially when there's not a lot of units, rent goes up and more people are priced out.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I also enjoyed that book and thought it was clarifying that there's much less homelessness in places like Mississippi, where I think houses are like $10 there or $15 something in that range. So do you think Sacramento has done a good job of supporting housing projects here in Fresno? And are there things that at a statewide kind of regulatory level would make it easier to expand housing stock in Fresno?
Yeah, I think the state is doing a lot. I've enjoyed the last few years that they've tried to make their applications easier and more streamlined, and they deserve credit for OFA, which took some four different programs that all had a bunch of different timings, and they put them together. And that was a good move. And they're now creating a new housing agency to streamline it even more and to put tax credits and the Housing Community Development Division under one roof and to have one application. So it doesn't always move as fast as people would like, but they're definitely moving in the right direction. I think the money that the state brought to downtown Fresno is and is going to be transformative to help with infrastructure, parking, and to do the revolving loan fund to the downtown housing projects. I think it's very positive. So yeah, I think they're doing a lot. A lot of the laws, I think, though, that have passed, people have been somewhat disappointed that it hasn't moved the needle. It does seem the governor was very intent on moving the needle and it was a top priority. And at some point, there was lots of money flowing to it, but there wasn't quite the impact. And so I think a lot of people are scratching their heads and thinking what else would actually need to change. And that's something I think about a lot and interested to talk to people to find an answer to.
When I'm thinking about housing issues, I tend to think about four different domains that affect housing development. One is financing, then we have regulation, land use, and then the inevitable local politics that affect whether development projects like the housing development in Northwest Fresno get approved or not, or whether they have to go to courts because people are nervous about apartments in neighborhoods. Which of those do you think is the biggest obstacle to housing development in Fresno? And again, those are like financing, regulation, land use, and local politics.
I'd put it a tie between regulation and land use. And in some ways, I see those as connected. Land use is a type of regulation.
Yeah.
It is hard to build, and you want everyone to follow all these rules and to be able to do it. But my family's also got an ancestral property in the highlands of Jalisco down in Mexico. And you can really see a difference about the different like pros and cons of different development systems. And it was very easy and we didn't need to pull permits and we started the next week and it's pretty inexpensive. But they have different rules for if you're out in like the rural area versus urban, and then it's a little bit more strict, but still. But then when it rains really hard, you're like, oh my gosh, like things are flooding. And there's pluses and minuses, but we've added a regulatory regime over time that makes the quality of our housing higher and higher. And it makes it so that we need more professionals at every step of the way. And then things also get long timelines and very complicated and more costs getting added. And so sometimes it feels like we're a little out of balance about how to try to make sure that we have good, safe places for people to stay, but we're also helping to make it easy and also keeping the cost so people can afford it.
We're going to transition here and jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch
Oh.
of things at you and you tell me whether you think they're over underrated and why.
Sure.
All right. Feel free to pass on any of these. We'll start with the one I ask everybody, me and Ed's pizza.
I just discovered Pacifica Pizza, and so I'm going to say overrated.
Okay. Do you not, is it the crust that gets you, or you just think there's better options out there?
I'm in my 40s, so I'm going on 30 years of eating me and Ed's. And so I think I've just been there, done that, and ready for a different pizza sometimes. But I do love them.
Okay, next one. What's the most underrated bar in Fresno? As we're going to talk about
I
your
do
bar
not.
here in a second, but I wanted to get your perspective on the landscape. What do you think is the one that deserves more attention for how good it is?
I like Goldstein's. What is that?
Yeah,
Goldstein's
the beer bar.
Mortuary and Delicatessen. Yeah. If I go out, that's where I'm going. And I love the vibe. I love the people. It was close to where I lived. They got like really cool music, sometimes just like a shopping cart, like hanging out in there, sometimes an arcade game. They got like giant tic-tac-toe or whatever in the back. It's just fun. At one point they had an alien diorama on the roof. So like you go out to get, you know, a new look on things. And so I just like how that place makes me feel. And I'm happy that they opened
Yeah, it's the dirt in your fingernails type place
that.
where, like, you don't, because I think there's this assumption that everyone always wants to go to a neat and noir style bar where it's just, it has a certain kind of energy. And we'll talk about your bar in a second. But sometimes just people just kind of want a divey thing. And I like the Brig on Blackstone sometimes, but there are two beers on tap sometimes doesn't satisfy my need. And those well drinks can have a lot of ice. So it just depends on the situation. But oftentimes I'm looking for something that's a little more fun. All right. Parking meters in downtown.
That's a good one. I'm for it. I'm working a little bit with the Downtown Fresno Partnership or Foundation. I always get them confused, but I'm trying to get some tuk-tuks to go from the parking garages to do a little tour between some of the amenities, the stadium, the convention center, the theater, and the brewery district. And I think that would make things a lot of fun and be the best of both worlds. But I think it's good that you rotate parking and it should be high demand and downtowns should be walkable. So I'm for it.
Okay. QR code menus.
Don't like it. And I was very happy where we landed on that as far as McQueen's, but we felt like we don't want people to bring out their phones. It's a vibe killer. And
Yeah.
so the idea that you would pick up a good old-fashioned laminated thing and
Oh,
then
I'm so
talk
happy
to
you're saying this.
a good old-fashioned person at the bar and kind of order and they can tell you stuff like it's the human experience often that we're seeking. And so we want to give people that when they come to
I hate those fucking things. Those QR code menus, I hate them
the
so much. It's the
bar.
worst. And you're just like, because you're like expanding the menu with your
Yeah.
like pincher fingers and you're trying to figure it. It's the worst.
Yeah.
Next one, track homes.
That's where they're all the same and you build them. I think I used to. Is this overrated and underrated
Yes,
still?
sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm gonna maybe surprise everybody and go underrated. My sister lives up north, and I just love the landscaping on a lot of them. And homes might be similar, but I'm often impressed that the yards can be different. And I'm sure there's different kind of versions of them. She lives kind of like northwest. But I say that because it's like, how are they rated normally? And I think tract homes are rated pretty poorly nowadays. People have turned on it. They're not in vogue.
They're easy to
But
shit on.
yeah, but they're efficient to build and they have great yards. And I'm like a small house, big yard kind of person. And I think I, in my own evolution, I'm just trying to hate things less. And so I'm trying to see the good in those homes.
Perfect. Next one, espresso martinis.
I don't think I've ever had one. I think martinis are just taste like alcohol squared to me. I'm like, where's, is this a mixed drink or just alcohol?
It's true.
But we did a cool thing. It was like a Stockholm flight. And so McQueen's is going to have that hopefully for brunch. And the last one was like an espresso Stockholm. And it was so dense that it like melted your face. And then I requested that I can't feel my face when I'm with you song. And it was just like, I think it's going to be a lot for a lot of people, but sometimes we need a lot, Jordan. And I was for it.
Yes. Sometimes mixing alcohol and caffeine doesn't turn out well for me, but you just it depends on the person.
Sometimes it does. Sometimes it does.
Okay, next one. The bus system in Fresno.
I'm going to say overrated. I feel like it's empty a lot of the time, and I'm very onto this more like on call, on response. I went to studied abroad in Barbados, and they had these cool vans, and they could drive you to the grocery store, and they were always like rocking tunes super loud. And so I'm more into flex transportation that really serves people, but to have really big vehicles and then you still have to walk to where you're going, it seems like maybe we could have more smaller ones and help people to get where they need to go.
Agreed. Yeah, I don't. I just the density question is always the question with busing systems. Next one, bartenders with suspenders.
I'll probably go overrated. Like,
They all
you
need them. They all need them for some reason. I don't understand
know,
why there's such a pants issue in the bartender.
yeah, exactly. I use the belt, each their own.
Next one, William Saroyan.
He's Ray, I'll say underrated. I don't know
Okay.
that people are really reading his stuff or knowing it. I'm always getting the Divine Comedy or the Human Comedy. I think his was the Human Comedy, but I was just learning about biblical writing style and how Hemingway actually borrowed from it. And I think there's something to dignified simplicity. And I think Saroyan had that. I think Gary Soto is a Valley writer. I think like we in the Valley, you know, at our best kind of exemplify that. And so he kept it uncomplicated, but it was also like elevated. And so I haven't read much of his stuff, but I remember back in the day reading that and just feeling like pretty good.
Yeah, my favorite is My Name is Elam. That's a it's his version of kind of Tom Sawyer for the Central Valley. All right, two more tiki bars.
Underrated.
Okay, you a tiki bar guy?
I love like Hawaiian culture, and not that tiki bars are a great representation of Hawaiian culture, but it's like you probably get a bit of the relaxed feel. Like, I'm not sure if you've been over to Hawaii. They call us mainlanders and they look at us weird because we're so stressed. And I think a tiki bar is a nice like embassy of aloha
Yeah,
in the
there's a
city.
wild one in Bakersfield. It's like downstairs in the
Oh,
building,
man.
and it's just you almost feel like the walls are moving in ways they shouldn't. And I love that energy. All right, last one, tiny homes, over or underrated?
At this point, again, it's just the evolution. I'm going to say
Yeah.
overrated. I feel like people keep calling them units and look how cheap it is, but oftentimes it's like they're getting smaller and less homey.
Yeah.
And I'm all for small efficiency and whatever you need, but also it's hard when you compare like a two-bedroom apartment to essentially an office or just like a one-room box and say, hey, look, I'm creating housing for much cheaper. But I wish we had more. I want like tiny home parks. I want people to own things. I want starter homes and that kind of stuff. But a little bit right now, it definitely seems like they're in vogue. I like cozy homes, is what I call them. And so they're still like human scale.
Yeah, I joke and call them divorce homes because a box that small, conflict is inevitable. All right, let's talk about Moses McQueen's. Give us the kind of quick rundown on the origin story. Where did this idea come from, and how did you land on that building there?
Yeah, I think my brother Diego, he knows a lot of people, and he knew, I think, somebody like city manager type person or down. Oh, I think it was a downtown partnership person. There was an old building for sale. It was abandoned and about to be torn down. And so we saw an opportunity where I think most people saw ruin. So we got it at a really good price. We just put together some partners, high school friends, didn't really know what to do, thought office, but wanted to do something, I think, more to help downtown. Landed on a bar. One of the partners, Phil, really saw that. It's a good location by the stadium, by the DoubleTree. We were blessed in two ways. One was that the brewery district blossomed while we were trying to get everything in order. And the second was that right before we were supposed to start rehab, COVID happened. And not that's good for anybody, but it was good that we hadn't just opened because
Yeah.
that would have been a very challenging environment. So it's taken us like a really long time, but it feels like there's a groundswell there. And yeah, we just wanted to do something cool with it. So we totally fixed up the old building best we could. Our little tagline sometimes is grandma's house has a liquor license. And so we just wanted to feel like a house party, a backyard, everybody's welcome.
Yeah. So can you describe what, when you envision this bar, what did you envision the personality of the bar to be?
We try to talk about that, like target market or the personality, but it's pretty much maybe you, Jordan, you know?
I'm the target market. Okay.
Yeah, it wants to have like long conversations that go off side tangents, and then let's order some fries and get another one. And oh, look who just came in, and that reminds me of, and maybe you didn't plan to stay as long as you did, but you do. And for me, again, I like going to the delicatessen if I ever go out. And so just an energizing place that is affirming to what people need for social activity and just good old-fashioned fun.
Okay. And how do you think Moses McQueen's will work in conjunction with the downtown brewery district, the large hotel that's right next door? Do you see it as its own newer district, or are you absorbing yourself into this broader brewery district? How do you think about it?
Well, technically, we're on Gallery Row and
Okay,
they
fair
put
enough.
up the flags there, but that is literally the block over from the brewery district. And so I see us as an extension of that. And hopefully, people will walk the block over and we'll all be part of that. As far as the hotel, my brother just invited some of his coworkers to a tasting and they were saying they could see our backyard from the window.
Oh,
And
wow.
so I think that's our marketing, right? You get over there, you unpack your bags, you open the window shades, and then you see the party in the backyard, and then you just walk on over. Hopefully, yeah, we're just kind of part of that downtown mix.
Okay, one slightly negative question, because I think a lot of people romanticize the idea of opening a bar, but then there's all these other kind of challenges that are unforeseen. What does it actually look like to open a bar? Versus what you pictured or envisioned, or the kind of romantic visions that a lot of people have. A lot of people want to own a bar, but they maybe don't know what goes into it.
Yeah, it almost goes back to our development question before, but it is hard every step of the way. And just make sure you're doing an idea that you're willing to stick with and that you're doing it with people that you love and care about, because it is not going to be going to the corner store and grabbing some milk, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It was very challenging to get a loan for the property. And so that was like years in the making. It was challenging to rehab an older house and do all that kind of stuff. More recently, as some people might be aware, it's a challenging to finish the rehab and kind of and
Yes.
get open. But reflecting on it, I have found I think 3 to 4 people is the sweet spot. If I was doing it alone, I would have crumbled already, been worn out. It would be overwhelming. If we had 7 to 10, it would be so hard to make a decision and get consensus. And so 3 to 4, you're still going to rub each other a little bit, but it's enough that you can keep moving forward. But it's also enough you could take a weekend off and somebody keeps it going. So we're like a relay team in the track and field. And so you can pass the baton and we take different aspects of it. And so I would just say, find a good group that you trust, and that'll help a lot.
One of the questions I got from a friend after I told him I was going to talk to you about Moses McQueen's was parking. How are you guys thinking about the parking issue around where you are? Because you're on a main thoroughfare there, and it's complicated with downtown parking.
Yeah. So we are looking at getting an adjacent lot and having that be temp parking, and then eventually developing perhaps some storefront there and still having parking in the back. And so we're in discussions with that. For the immediate, I'll go back to my tuk-tuk idea. I was just very into like e-bike rickshaws and also these low-speed vehicles that are just, it's almost like a fun party cart or something. And you see it from a distance. Sometimes in tower, I'll see the like pedal bar come by, and you can hear it before you can see it. And it's just giggles and hooting and hollering. And then it comes by. It's like joy on wheels. And so I think having this kind of smaller transportation to help people get between venues downtown, and then really starting to use our main parking lots, garages in different parts. But I think I could get on board and used to parking my car in a garage and then riding a fun tuk wherever I needed to go and coming back. And so, yeah, we're trying to get a lot nearby, and we definitely want that for like our lunch crowd and stuff like that. But also recognize that parking will always be a problem in downtown, particularly if it gets popping, which is what we want. And so thinking of a solution where people can all park their car in one spot, and then the rest of downtown's for walking and having fun.
Yeah. Water comes out of my nose when I hear people complain about downtown parking. I'm like, this is about as simple as it can be. Like, it is not, you're not trying to park in the marina in San Francisco on a Friday night. Let's be right real here.
Yeah.
What cocktail on the menu are you most excited about?
That's a tough one. It's almost hard to remember them all at this point, particularly after the third one in the tasting.
Which one did you want to come back to the most?
I'll go with the Stockholm flight, and I'll go with that like dark and dirty last one, which was like some kind of espresso Stockholm. It was just so dense. You could almost chew it or something. Yeah. It was just really satisfying, and it was also like aromatic, so that it was in your mouth and out your nose. Speaking of coming out your nose for kind of 5-10 minutes, it like changed the mood. It was like an incense. It wafted into the environment, and to me that was just very alluring.
How do you think about pricing cocktails? I know there's cocktails are evolving in a lot of ways. You have your well cocktails that kind of hover around that $10 range, but then you have your signature cocktails that are in that kind of 14 to 17 range. How did you guys think and come to a conclusion on how to price cocktails at your bar?
I think we trusted our GM.
Yeah.
Don, shout out to Don Chianchi, and she's helped with some of the brewery district bars and menus and has a good kind of track record of opening bars and managing them. So lean in on her expertise, but our direction as owner operators is just, hey, here's the market we want to serve. And I love and go to modernist, but I don't think we're trying to be upscale, and we're not totally the diviest of the dive. And so I think we just want to be an affordable place where people are happy to come. And we might not get all the money in the one high price cocktail, but hopefully they'll come back next time and bring some friends, and we'll just make do that way.
I know there's a lot of bars in Fresno that have done this kind of reservation system, which I've always had mixed feelings about, because for me, like, my best bar experiences was when I was living in San Francisco. I was in the Mission. It was Saturday night, and I was in a bar where, like, I couldn't take two steps in a direction. Like, it was literally, it was like sardine can tight. It was wild. Yeah. I couldn't hear shit. People were like, it was constant friction with the people I was standing. Like, I had to scream at the bartender to get a drink, but that's the place I wanted to be. Like, that's not every bar experience. I think a crowded bar is actually the point half the time.
Yep.
So how do you think about bar reservations in that world?
Yeah, nothing for downstairs, no lunch reservation, no bar, nothing. We do have an upstairs space that is like our event space, birthday parties, office lunches, that kind of thing. And we are looking at software to help with the management of that. a little bit with my work with a nonprofit, you realize you can spend a lot of time on an Excel sheet or something. And so it pays to automates a lot of the stuff, updates a calendar everybody can see. Downstairs, it's a free-for-all, Jordan. You're hopefully in a
That's
sardine
what I signed
can.
Up for. Yeah, there we go.
Upstairs is like, hey, book it in advance so you can make sure you got your space.
Yeah. Last question on the bar before we talk about farmers markets. Let's say you were the bar czar of downtown.
Bar czar, I like that.
Yeah. And like, you were like, this, a lot of downtown districts, they need a lot of offerings in order to create that kind of ecosystem of energy. And we need more bars downtown, full stop. What could we do to make that simpler, you think, if you were the bar czar?
To make opening a bar simpler?
Yeah. Yeah. Because you just talked about all the challenges and the years it took and those kinds of things. Is there things we could do as a city to make that simpler?
I mean, the city's been super supportive, and so bless them. And they did create, I think in 2014, the downtown code that made nightlife really easy and you could be open late and noise ordinance type stuff. So they've done a good job of doing all that. I think it's a lot of times just the development process itself.
The financing element, is that the biggest obstacle you think?
That's a big part of it. And, you know, financiers, they don't really like people trying something for the first time, but often you can't be a veteran until you've got your first shot. And so it's a little bit like chasing your tail on that one. And
like an FHA loan for bar owners, some kind of simpler process.
Or you know what I would do to answer this? I'd like, what do they call those? An incubator. I think it would be cool if there was a building and it had a few spots. You could test your thing just by renting the space. Yeah. And then if you can show cash flow and something, you graduate to a loan and maybe a location.
Yeah. So like a Mercado, like they have in Mexico or some cities where you can rent a stall.
Get a stall. Yeah, a bar stall.
Yeah, exactly. I love those. Those are fun. You just Let's talk about farmers markets. What got you interested in working on farmers markets?
I had just moved back to Fresno after teaching abroad, and I was very into our U.S. system of private land ownership. I had just come from China, where that's not, doesn't really exist. And yeah, I was just looking around at these properties and found one kind of weird peanut shaped one by a canal about a block from where I grew up in South Tower. And so got it for a song, and a little bit, it was a test cheaply. I could develop some housing, and my dreams were dashed. And I think that's the unfortunate part. A lot of people have ideas to improve their community, but they run into the system, which is well-intentioned, but doesn't care about your dreams that much. I took some courses, incremental development came through. Dan Zack, the old head planner before he retired, helped me vision that, hey, we can't really build anything on this space for the budget. It was too small. We had to give an easement to the canal, but we could still activate it. And that was what I was looking for. So it's a little bit like the entrepreneur's story where you just pivot and pivot until you find a way through the dark woods. And so having a temporary farmer's market, I had loved going to Portland where they would have kind of corner food courts as part of their neighborhoods and people would come with their kids. Also traveling around Taiwan night markets and stuff like that, where there's just different offerings and you can eat and walk and different people can get different things, but then go to the same picnic table. And so it was like, hey, I wish we had stuff like that. Hey, this is a great neighborhood. It's near Tower. It's by the canal, which is really nice half of the year because it's like a river. The other half, not as nice, but that was the idea. And it took an awful long time, but we're hoping to open in April.
Yeah, I think that I love walking and eating and grazing and looking at things. I think it's healthy for us. It's way better than like the cold bag of Uber Eats fries that arrives and you're like, the alcohol is wearing off. So this is now not that appealing. And so just having spaces, third spaces is that kind of overused term, but there's just not enough of it.
Overrated, Jordan.
It's way overrated, but I think if I'm looking at kind of demographics and culture of a neighborhood where you're designing this, it seems like there would be no better neighborhood to have some kind of, because people are out and about in Tower. There's always movement. There's always traffic. What has been the community feedback on the idea of a farmer's market in the neighborhood?
It's been good. A lady shouted to me yesterday, "When you gonna open? I'm hungry." And I was like, all right,
That's called a
like,
focus group.
yeah. You know, it was hard, Jordan, and there were times where I'm like there on the weekend, staining tables, like in the sun and getting woozy, or like digging the hard pan and trying to plant and feeling a bit all alone and underappreciated. And it was literally the people walking by. Yes, hey, that's great. Hey, can't wait to come. And that kind of stuff fills your spirit so that you realize what you're doing. So that kind of neighborhood feedback, like who doesn't want an empty lot to turn into a fresh market food court? And so that was generally good. There was a little bit, sometimes you start these things, they take so long. And as it's going, you realize more why you did it or what you're doing. But they did the sidewalk vendor ban for a little bit in the tower. And so it was like they really needed a safe place where vendors could try to make a business. They're small business owners. They're often hustling very hard, trying to like provide good, cheap food. So, yeah, the idea that, hey, we're creating a space to facilitate this thing that's like a win-win. You activate a space in a neighborhood, you help small businesses, you provide food to people in the neighborhood. Even though it's hard, it could be good.
Yeah. I love those kind of very similar, those seemingly abandoned lots in Austin that have been taken over by all these food trailers and food trucks. And it's just kind of dirt and picnic tables. And you're just out there with tacos and then grabbing some flowers to apologize from the night before. Like it's these kind of spaces are great, incredible. And do you think the biggest obstacle to having more of these is just land use and zoning?
You know, I think there are quite a few and you see them popping up, but most of them seem informal and probably unregulated. And the idea with the nonprofit that we started there was the idea that we could spread it, do it. It does seem like this might be the only one, and we're going to pass it and donate it to South Tower Community Land Trust that just opened their office a half block away. They got a grant to manage. But yeah, I think each neighborhood very easily could have one. I think maybe it's the code. I'm not sure if the neighborhood mixed use and the commercial Main Street zoning was just for kind of downtown and downtown adjacent neighborhoods, or if that expands throughout the city. But that's the one that has the farmers market, temporary farmers market designation, and pretty much water, power, foundation, drive approaches, lighting. It's pretty easy. And I was talking to somebody from South Tower yesterday, and they're thinking about doing like a development how-to book. And I thought that was beautiful. One of the board members
Yes.
is a user experience engineer designer. And so it's like how to help people who have a dream for their neighborhood, but who aren't versed in the details, make it through the dark forest of regulation to get to the other side. And once you do it once, you feel like, okay, that was good. But you almost don't want to do it again, even though now you know how. But I really liked their vision of trying to help people do that. And a little bit of the collaborative too, like when I see and talk to people, that's what I try to do, is to encourage them, but also educate just about what some of the challenges could be.
Yeah, it almost seems like addict behavior. Like it's amazing when the project's finished, but you're like, never again. And then they're back the next week. You're like, wait a second, you said never again, never again. All right, Miguel, we close these podcasts with book recommendations with each episode. What are a few books that have either been important to you or you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Yeah, one that I just read and was amazing, and I lent it to our bar manager, is The Master and His Emissary. And I think that one's Ian McGilchrist. And so he was a literature professor at Oxford that then got a PhD, I believe, in neuroscience. And he does this cultural analysis of our left and our right brain. And we've got these different hemispheres, and they operate in different ways. And you can separate them, and they're almost like two different selves that operate. And his thesis is that we've really moved too far into the left hemisphere, which is very analytical, but doesn't really absorb whole information and create meaning. And so he really feels strongly the right hemisphere can help heal and correct some of the kind of logic madness almost that the left side does. So I really liked that one. And a little bit, I'm reading a lot lately, but a little bit, I like this one here, On the Aesthetic Education of Man by Friedrich Schiller. And so that's back in the 1700s, but he was cool. I think he was disappointed with the French Revolution, that things didn't quite turn out well, and that like politics wasn't an answer to the problems really facing people. And so he looks to art as a way to create like an enduring sense of beauty that then can filter into our actions to create the kind of world that we all want to live in.
Those are great recommendations. To close, where can people find out more about the bar? When's the grand opening? And people want to follow the updates with the farmers market. So information stuff.
Yeah, the bar, mosesmcqueens.com. You got Instagram, that kind of stuff. We were just joking by text this morning that we're opening on April Fool's Day, because literally that kind of seems like it. We said March 14th, but we seem a little late. But also we've been hard to nail a date. So April Fool's feels like good place to land on.
Yeah, that's perfect. And then in terms of farmers market, it's sometime in the later spring.
Yeah. We were hoping to make Porch Fest April 11th, but we've got to get a street work permit, and that takes a little bit. And if all goes well, fingers crossed, mid end of April, but things hard to predict.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Miguel. This was fun chatting.
Yeah. Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review, or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/FresnosBest. We'll see you next time.